This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Should teachers be put in front of the line for vaccinations in order to get them back in school? How about legislators in order to get them back working in state capitals like Springfield? Should we allow teachers and legislators and other people deemed more important than you, or essential, I guess is the term that's used, jump the line? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. We see this around the country. It's not just Chicago. Montgomery County, Maryland, public schools closed since last March, one of those places dominated by lockdowners. Many private schools decided to open, but the county's vaccination plan prioritizes public school teachers over employees of private school teachers. So it's not just teachers versus everybody else. It's also government school teachers versus private school teachers. I thought they're both teaching kids.
It's not fair. But then again, what's fair in life? It's happening. It's all over the place. And the teachers said that they're not going to go back unless they're vaccinated. That's one of their sticking points. And the CDC director, look what she said yesterday. Do you need vaccinations to be safe at school?
Vaccination of teachers is not a prerequisite for safe reopening of schools.
Did you hear that, teachers? It's not a prerequisite for a safe reopening of schools.
It's not a prerequisite. Why do you need a pronouncement from the CDC director? Look around at all the schools that have been open for months and months and months on end.
We've had 130 Catholic private Jewish schools, the French school, that have been open since August. No reports, student-to-teacher transmission, and 2,000 early learning centers that have been open since the pandemic started. That's some that never closed. So, yeah, to go in front of the line, but Pritzker made this big pronouncement yesterday that the Democratic lawmakers, because two of them got sick, one was Chris Walsh's assistant, got COVID from that special session that they had, the veto session, and that's why the lawmakers want to be considered phase 1B people is when it comes to vaccines.
So, jumping the line because, as Pritzker said, he needs state government, quote, to function well, unquote. So we're just a few vaccinations of legislators away from the General Assembly functioning well, as I understand it. In fact,
laughable.
This was a bit surprising to me on multiple fronts. I didn't know we still had a General Assembly. I thought that had been disbanded. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line, Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Hey, good morning, you guys. I just saw a teacher interviewed on the news last night. She must have been 25 or something. She won't go back because she wants to have a family someday, and she wants to be safe. You know, you just really, you just don't know who's going to die. But, you know, I mean, that's what she was saying. And if you're 20-something years old, I mean, give me a break. My mom is 85. She has been looking all over the place trying to get registered, like you were saying, Amy, how hard it is for them to navigate Walgreens.
And websites, they don't upload, download. They don't even know what that means.
I know. You said that before, and it's so true. My mom is like, how the hell do you find a freaking vaccine? And she wants it. You know, she doesn't want to. She figures she deserves it. I mean, she'd like to be around a few more years, watch her grandchildren grow a little older. I mean, what the hell? I'm sorry. It's just same old BS everywhere you go. I'm sick of the teachers. And I know, Dan, you said you can't fire them and they're in a position of power, but they can work towards that. You know, a principal of an Englewood school lives down the street from me, and she said, I asked her how many teachers she's ever fired over her career, and she said two. Mm-hmm. Two.
Right.
Give me a break.
And they probably were reinstated.
Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Well, I mean, I'm not saying you can't fire teachers. I'm saying the people in charge won't fire teachers, won't institute any discipline, won't hold anybody to account, won't represent the interests of the children, won't represent the interests of the parents and families they are ostensibly there to serve. So I guess the question comes down to parents and families, the other stakeholders in the school district that never seem to get much quarter or attention. If you're not going to get reaction from them, then don't be surprised when those people in charge, you know, run over you. and continue to escalate their conditions to work. That's all. Jim in Crown Point.
I'm all for giving the politicians the vaccine first because they said then they could do their job. They haven't done it all this time. I didn't realize it just took a vaccine to make them do their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And the CTU, they hate me. And I had heard from another teacher who wants to go back to school that any parent that disagrees with the CTU, they're going to troll on social media.
That's scary.
Well, no. I mean, I've never gotten hit so hard in my life because I went on Fox and Friends. Ever. Big from parent. One wrote, only 8 kids have died. I'm sorry they're dead. No, you're effing not. You're selfish. You don't care about anyone. You just care about your kids because you want them out of the house. 8 kids is too many. If checking in on your kids, Amy's mental health is such a burden, you shouldn't have become a mother. Mm-hmm. This is constant, and it's constant every day. They're thugs. Another mom who stood up for herself, and they're trying to get her fired from her job because she called them cult members, and Stacey Davis Gates didn't like that. And now they're out to get that woman, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Call Jeff Reisman, okay? I'll give you Marcus Brown's phone number.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just not particularly impressed that anybody in this discussion is analogous to the men who stormed the beach at Normandy, which is how they're characterizing themselves. Please, spare me. Somebody's going to call you a name. Oh, I'm sorry, what do you teach your kids again? That's the excuse? That's the cover story? Somebody's going to troll you on social media?
I don't care. I don't have to worry about losing my job. But other people do.
Uh-huh.
And that's why a lot of CPS parents haven't come forward.
Yeah.
And then there's the selective enrollment aspect of it. Well, if I'm in middle school and I say something, Jimmy's not going to get into Walter Payton Prep. Okay, well, Jimmy's not going to go to school this year or next year or probably the year after that.
Jim in Naperville.
You know, if we're going to, if the Illinois legislature is so important, their health is so important, can we start regulating their dietary intake and their exercise regimen? And maybe they could use an enema, you know, to cleanse their bowels every so often. You know, let's set up a regimen for that.
All right.
Well,
Jim.
Let's, you know, get on the Vitality program. Check out your cholesterol.
The other Jim in Palatine.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good.
I wish they would think more about the real frontline workers, or not frontline, but essential workers like us construction workers that have not missed a day of work in any size of our industry ahead of these people while they haven't showed up for work yet. So why not give it to the people that are actually doing the work?
Thanks for the call, Jim.
Or just tell them to all go make solar panels.
Here's
too afraid to teach.
I don't know how we get so far afield. You know, this is so emblematic of like a kleptocratic culture where somebody says I should be able to jump the line because I'm me, because of my job. And then the reaction isn't, here's how we're going to do this. The reaction is, why don't I get to jump the line because I'm doing more than that person who wants to jump the line. Here's the thought. What do we know about COVID-19? It is exponentially more lethal for people over the age of 65 than under the age of 65. So how about keep it simple? How about we stick to what we know to be true and we just move forward with vaccinating people by age cohort, regardless of race or profession or anything else?
Yep.
How about that? Rather than everybody running to say, F the teachers and F the politicians. It should be me or it should be somebody else or no. How about making sense? How about just consistently articulating the proper position based on what we know?
Well, also, too, have them stand in line instead of registering and answering 52 questions and then uploading a picture of their insurance card. I mean, it's a lot of work. Just do what they did in Florida. Sit in your cars and wait. If you get the vaccine, fine. If you don't, come back the next day.
Joe on 294.
Yes, good morning. Yeah, you're right, Dan. That is the best way to do it, age-related. Start with the oldest and proceed onward. you know, there's hundreds of millions of people that go to work every day, let alone do their own things that they have to do without the vaccine. And they don't complain. What I would say for the teachers and politicians, just give them a pacifier and be done with it.
Well, yeah, and here's JB, or the governor, further explaining his position of why the Democratic lawmakers need this vaccine.
We had 7 months or so, even longer, without any legislation really going through the, there was no meeting of the General Assembly from May all the way through to the lame duck session. So I now believe that we'll be able to move forward. We have so many things to accomplish.
And so that's, you know, they want to make sure that they can gather once again. And the only way to gather safely is if they're vaccinated.
Steve and Gary.
Yeah, good morning, Dan and Amy. I'm going to tell you what about them teachers. The only beaches they've ever stormed are North Avenue Beach and Oak Street Beach, for crying out loud. And Amy, you can give it back to them, too. You know, I know you don't. We don't play their games, but, you know, hey, tit for tat, why not? Have a little fun with them. Have a great day.
Thanks, Steve.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Guess the final score of this Sunday's big game, and you could win $50,000. Enter today at 560theanswer.com/score.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Fact check from ABC News. No link between COVID-19 vaccines and those who die after receiving them. Very interesting, these fact checkers for the D.C. press corps outlets. They note to isolated cases of adverse reactions and death after having received the vaccine, but there's no causal link. Perhaps that's right, but I can't help but note in this ABC piece, in fact, did you know an average of 8,000 people die each day in the United States?
Oh,
some of them may have just received a coronavirus vaccine. Now we're putting numbers in context. Now we are.
8,000 people die a day in America. 300 die in the state of Illinois a day before COVID happened.
So there are people posting about the reactions, adverse reactions to the vaccine. And again, it's not taking a position in opposition to the vaccine, but it's, I mean, we talk about isolated cases with respect to COVID, anomalous cases. They're wildly amplified. There's a piece in the New York Times. My 6-year-old has the coronavirus. I'm trying to stay calm. She's not succeeding, by the way. We'll get back to that. But, I mean, just to give you examples of some tweets that were compiled. Nurse who works at an elderly care home just told me that 72-year-old woman died from the Oxford vaccine, AstraZeneca, and they have had nothing but serious problems with another 8 people since they had it. Another, I work for health service. At work yesterday, had 4 severe vaccine reactions. 2 of these had serious chest pains and dizziness. Other flu symptoms, can't leave the bed. 1 numbness and tingling and stroke symptoms. 3 of 4 were sent to the hospital. Ironically enough, none had COVID issues. Another woman talked about she had previously had anaphylactic shock from bee stings.
Ooh.
And she said, if you had ever had anaphylaxis shock in the past, you can't get the vaccine. They knew this. I didn't. I still got the vaccine. Now I'm waiting to see if there's any more consequences for choosing to do what I thought was the right thing to do. There's the report about, some high profile cases. Larry King, Larry King's son. This is tweeted out by a guy who interviewed Larry King's son when Larry King, it was announced that he was sick. I just wrapped an interview with my friend Larry King Jr. He tells me his dad is expected to fully recover from COVID-19, will receive the vaccine before he's released from the hospital, and he wants me to tell you all to wear a mask. Uh-huh. Huh. Hammer and Hank Aaron, the real home run king, he got the vaccine on January 5th.
Right. He posted it on Twitter, too, saying, I hope you do the same.
This was at Morehouse College, and then he died a couple of weeks
17,
later.
He died 17 days later, but the Fulton County Medical Examiner, Dan, wants everyone to know that he died from natural causes and not from complications from the vaccine.
It may
but
be.
How do they even, and that's, you know, because old people pass away. He was 86 years old.
That may be, but, you know, are we getting sort of a full handle on the incidence, the frequency, and the scope of adverse reactions to the various vaccines? That's all.
Yeah, and 23 people in Norway died. They were in a nursing home, 93 years and older. 23 died after getting the vaccine. Some were a week, some were a few days. But in that case, they were saying old people die. They didn't die from the vaccine. They died from natural causes. But do you believe it? 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Amy and Dan. My daughter is 35. She's a healthcare worker. She had the vaccine a couple of weeks ago. The first shot, no problem. The second shot, she came down with a low-grade fever and pretty much took the day off because she was not well. And then since then, she's been fine. One other final comment, your previous discussion on teachers. What profession out there can you really do a bad job and not get fired? I mean, look at our students in Chicago, how well they're performing. And I wonder how many teachers get relieved of their jobs for turning out a lousy product.
Thanks for the call, Bob.
Good point, Bob.
Debbie in Rochelle.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I had my first vaccination shot a couple weeks ago and just had a sore arm. Tuesday, I had my second one. Yesterday, I came down with 103 temperature and a very nasty headache. Plus, my two-year-old grandson has been diagnosed with COVID. He seems fine. My son and daughter-in-law also have it, and they're just ending the quarantine period. But for a two-year-old to get it, I was very surprised that he was even, you know, had a positive result.
Well, did he have any symptoms? So you're saying he was asymptomatic?
No, he was asymptomatic, just a little stuffy nose. That was it.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Debbie. Appreciate it. Tony in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan, Amy. Hey, that one guy. Yeah, you know who else gets paid for being wrong all the time? Weathermen. So we could start with that. But Dan, you know, every day talk about the same thing, day in and day out. We expect something to change, and nothing is changing because you have Pritzker, for instance, running around yesterday. Well, he doesn't really run, but yeah, taking a victory lap about administering so many vaccines, touting what he's doing. And nobody questions the obvious fact that he could have done this months ago, and he chose not to.
He waited.
And so the same people that were in support of the Obama administration, now the Biden administration, and telling everybody white is black and black is white, are now going to do the reverse positioning when it comes to every other situation. And they have the voice. So, yeah, what's going to change? Nothing. Nothing.
Thanks for the call, Tony.
Yeah, Pritzker waited until after Biden was, after the election, he waited.
Mm-hmm. Mike on the South Side.
Hello?
Hey, Mike.
Hi. My daughter died 3 days after her Gardasil vaccine. Doctors, it was written up originally as natural causes. I went to the Court of Special Masters in Washington, D.C. I got judgment. My daughter did die from her vaccine. And the best you're going to get is no fault injury.
Sorry to interrupt, Mike, and I'm sorry that your daughter passed, but did you say the Gardasil vaccine? So this wasn't COVID-related. It wasn't the COVID vaccine.
This wasn't COVID. It was the Gardasil, but
right. Pretty
much the same difference. It's the neurotoxins that are in the vaccine. What they have to do is poison your body to get a reaction from your immune system to react. Well, sometimes it's fatal. Not just on mine, but quite a few. But the one thing the doctors told me, last thing the doctor told me is that the benefits outweigh the risks. Mm. And that's not their decision to make.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
I'm sorry about your loss. What is that vaccine for?
HPV.
HPV. Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All our pediatricians are pushing for our kids to get the HPV vaccine.
Tom and Oswego.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Yeah, my wife is a teacher's aide, and she was, I'd say, encouraged to get hers yesterday. She did. and she came home and her arm has never been more sore. Now that could be from the shot. She's a small person, but mm-hmm. now she's sick. Now she's sick this morning, which she is very rarely sick. And I think she's probably not going to go to work today, and we're going to have to see what happens. She didn't have any symptoms. We are a little bit worried. I try to encourage her to wait a few months until other people get this and just see what's going on. But nevertheless, they, like I say, encouraged her because all the other teachers were going to get it. And if she didn't, you could imagine what would happen.
Oh, yeah.
Probably wouldn't be able to work.
Yeah, that's right.
They'd make your life hell.
Thanks for the call, Tom. I know people, you know, who have to, if their healthcare in the healthcare space, and if they, their office is being, the vaccine is being made available to their office. And if they choose not to take it, they have to sign a waiver, you know, to indemnify the doctor's office or whatever, that basically says, I'm a bad person. I know I'm putting myself and others at risk by not taking this vaccine. Sign here. So, of course, it's a not so subtle way to get everybody to take the vaccine. And again, these are anecdotes. And so unlike the charlatans that have dominated the airwaves for the last year, we are not over-extrapolating from the anecdotal. We're just asking the question and suggesting that it probably merits some data gathering to understand just what the incidence of adverse reactions in and the nature of those adverse reactions, sort of categorize them the same way we spend so much time talking about the reactions to COVID, categorizing those and counting those cases. That's all. That's what we're doing. And so I just want to distinguish what we do from what the professional fearmongers and TV doctors and politicians have done for the last year with respect to COVID, the virus, as opposed to our discussions of the COVID vaccines. Side by side. Larry in Elmhurst.
Hey, good morning. Good
morning.
I got both shots, and the second shot I got, I too got a high fever and was feeling like really lightheaded and severe arm pain. And yo, ma, hey.
What?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Nice. That's supposed to be some sort of spoof call. Okay.
Or maybe he was having a, you know. Effects from the vaccine that made him go a little cuckoo. Yeah,
yeah,
that's what he was
trying to
spoof us.
Maybe he was just out late at the gin joints in Elmhurst. Tony and Roselle.
Good morning. I was just calling you to say that I'm a longtime caller, you know me, and that I received the vaccine at the beginning of the month. And the next day I had a reaction or something, a chill. I attributed it to a reaction. And by Sunday and Monday, my family was ill. So we must have picked the virus up at the same time I was vaccinated. They still don't have their taste, a sense of taste and smell. They had flu-like symptoms for a few days. They recovered very nicely. We were lucky. And I only lost my taste and smell for 7 days. I never had a fever, ache, problem. I didn't know I was ill except for lack of taste. And my taste came back quite quickly. And, you know, I think the vaccine did something for me because the second shot came last week. And your full immunization doesn't happen for 3 weeks after your second shot. So I was just exposed early on, I guess, after the vaccination. But I was lucky in reaction. I was lucky in the illness, too. So,
thanks for the call, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
Dave in Downers.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Yeah, I fear vaccinations. My wife, who's 79 years old, very active. She was walking 5 miles a day, doing Pilates 3 days a week. On October 28th, she had a senior flu shot. And on the 7th of November, we went up to our cottage in Door County, walked 5 miles, biked, and so forth. The next day, she could hardly get out of bed. Mm-hmm. I drove her to the Good Sam Hospital in Downers Grove, and they assessed her with Guillain-Barré syndrome. She spent 46 days in the hospital, and she's doing rehab 3 days a week at Marion Joy now. So I have an adverse feeling about vaccinations.
Hmm. All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. Yeah, I mean, there's other people that report another tweet that was compiled. Received my first Pfizer vaccine on 23rd of December. And the 3rd of January was my symptoms. Started my symptoms, earache, headache, some facial numbness. On the 4th, I was diagnosed with Bell's palsy. Mm-hmm. Now on day 9 of steroids and just waiting to gain full recovery and so forth. And, you know, good. Look, if you're high risk with COVID, being put down for the count or a slight fever or arm soreness is probably a small price to pay. You know, the benefits outweigh the risk. If you're not in such a risky category with respect to COVID, you know, that's an open question, I would say. And I know this is all about, it's not just you, it's to save grandma and grandpa. I mean, again, what's the starting point here? The starting point here, and this is from renowned epidemiologist, Stanford epidemiologist John Ioannidis, says, what do we know? We know that the case fatality rate is at present something like 0.05%, which is essentially tantamount to a bad flu season. Dan in Lake Zurich.
Yeah, good morning, guys. We just know personally a nurse. She got her vaccines, and a few weeks afterwards, she tested positive for COVID twice and negative for COVID twice.
Hmm.
So not only is the vaccine apparently not helping, but the tests aren't correct.
Thanks, Dan.
We got a text message from the Amish texter. Let me get this straight. If you die from a heart attack, pneumonia, or the flu, it's COVID. But if you die from the vaccine, it's natural causes. That's
Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Thank you for taking the call. And my wife works in a doctor's office, and the doctor that she works for got the vaccine, the two-dose one, and on the second dose, he didn't make. Now this guy's a super healthy guy normally, and that he hurt from head to toe. Everything, he was never been more achy in his life. All kinds of other bad symptoms of being like equilibrium and all that stuff, and lost almost a week of work from it. And told the rest of the staff he wasn't going to take and push him to get the vaccine. It was up to them. He said it was a the response to the second dose.
The reaction, yeah. Thanks for the call, Craig. Appreciate it. Jim in Sheboygan.
Yes, so my daughter is a surgical tech, and she got the first shot because everybody at work is getting the shots. And there's a group of young women who are refusing to get the shot because they're afraid of the protein in the vaccine that can make it difficult to get pregnant. Because it affects the placenta. And so she's very concerned about actually after getting the first shot, getting the second shot, because she's concerned about long-term effects. And all I could do was encourage her to continue to research, and because her mother is COVID paranoid, so her mother's going to encourage her to do it. So she calls me on the phone on the way home from work because she doesn't want to have the conversation at home. That's it.
Thanks for the call, Jim. It's
helpful. My body, my choice.
Well, the World Health Organization recommended most pregnant women don't use the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines. That was last week.
They were not part of the test group. And they said that, they said that from the beginning, 16 and younger. And if you're pregnant, do not get the vaccine.
Well, that WHO recommendation came out January 27th.
Well, it was the CDC then that said it. But
Jordan, Forest Park.
You know, with the in the vaccine trials, it's important to know that when they were testing the effectiveness of the vaccine, they only counted people that had symptoms, and they did not check everybody to see if there were asymptomatic people that came down with COVID later. So people get the vaccine, there's still a good chance you're going to come down with COVID, but you may not have symptoms, or the symptoms may be mild. And I think people need to be aware of that.
Well, thanks for the call, Jordan. We talked about this, the Cheryl Atkinson report earlier in the week. She interviewed Thomas Massie, Republican congressman from Kentucky, and CDC continuing to report something that is not backed up by the clinical trials from the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, that if you've already had COVID, here's just another example, if you already had COVID, should you get the vaccine? The answer is no. Basically, the answer is you don't need it, but yet the CDC continues to sort of soft pedal the idea that you do need it, even after admitting to Representative Massie that the science from those clinical trials does not support the case that if you've been infected, you need to get vaccinated. So this is why you have to continue having these conversations about what we know, what the science tells us versus what is being reported or promoted. Because, look, you can talk all you want about trying to remove the politics from this. That ship has sailed long ago. So there are so many political agendas intersecting with the science and data that you need to keep talking this through and staying aware and asking questions.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The Trump legal team's answer to the article of impeachment filed earlier this week, as we went over yesterday, sort of indicated this, but one of his attorneys made it more clear that the stolen election claims will not be brought up during next week's impeachment trial. There are plenty of questions about how the election was conducted throughout the country, but that's for a different forum. And I don't believe that's important to litigate in the Senate trial because you don't need it. President Trump has plenty to win with what he has. Yeah. Kastner saying, I don't know where people got that notion that was some sort of litmus test, whether or not to pursue the election fraud charges as a litmus test to be on his defense team. I don't know where people got that notion that was some sort of litmus test to get to defend the president, because as you saw from the document I filed, which had to be approved by the president personally, there isn't anything in there about the election being stolen. And yet some Republicans and talk show hosts are promoting this idea that this is the perfect venue for President Trump and his legal team to prosecute the case of election irregularities.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Yeah, we know a lot of people who are looking forward to that, that thought that that was going to be the premise of the trial next week, but it's not, because it has nothing to do with his one-count charge of inciting violence.
Could it, though? It could. It's mentioned in the article of impeachment, but it would be legal malpractice to pursue that when you already have the straw vote that Rand Paul initiated in your back pocket with 45 Republican senators who essentially said the Senate doesn't have jurisdiction because he's out of office. So if you have an acquittal in your back pocket, what you do is you take the acquittal if you're representing somebody accused of a crime, or in this case, high crimes and misdemeanors in a political context. You take the win. And then Trump has that acquittal, number two, in his back pocket to use as a platform to say this was another star chamber that produced a show trial that was a waste of everybody's time. And now let's get back to our regularly scheduled whatever other issues he wants to talk about at that time. But next week is not the venue for that. I can't believe this is even in controversy, but it seems to be among some in Republican ranks. I get the desire to still the desire that persists to have some sort of reckoning for the irregularities that were not sufficiently explained. But I mean, let's, you know, pick our venues accordingly. Let's be judicious in where we prosecute the case and how we prosecute various cases. There's so many to prosecute, because there's something else afoot here that's much bigger than that, actually. The 2020 election? How about the next 20 years of elections? That's what the left is trying to do here. And by not addressing what they're trying to do, by going down that rabbit hole in that venue of the United States Senate on the election irregularities, you are aiding and abetting the marginalization of the Republican Party. Jonathan Tobin, our friend from Jewish News Syndicate, had a good piece on this over at The Federalist. What Trump's opponents have done is to launch a campaign that seeks to treat the quote-unquote insurrection as not just the fitting culmination of the Trump administration, but the prism through which to view the Republican Party as disloyal, authoritarian, and violent. By this means, all those members of the House and Senate who voted to challenge the Electoral College, the Electoral College results, can be labeled as accessories to insurrection. By painting with such a broad brush, the same can be retroactively applied to all those who raise questions about the election results, even if they oppose the January 6th challenge, and on from there to everybody who supported Trump in any material way at any time. This is an attempt to cast the Republican Party as a white supremacist confederacy that tried to overthrow the government for the next two generations, you understand? And I don't think Republicans, amid their, you know, should we or should we not remove Liz Cheney from leadership, and they didn't yesterday, as you know, should we or should we not strip Marjorie Taylor Greene of her committees, and we'll find out what today, they do today. Yeah. You're losing sight of the fact that you're again losing the rhetorical battle. You're allowing the left to brand you. And I'm not just talking about members of the House and Senate Republican caucuses. I'm talking about Republicans across the fruited plains. You're allowing them to brand you as accessories before or after the fact to an insurrection. And you have people within the party furthering that, like Adam Kinzinger, who did it again yesterday in a very riveting interview on The View. Boy, he really tackled the tough questions from those leftist man-hating shrews on The View. Such courage he has. He won't come on this show to have an adult conversation, but he'll go on The View echo chamber to say, yeah, you're so right, Whoopi and Joy. What a joke.
A star chaser, just like Obama.
So something to that.
There is.
Aaron
Schockett brought him down, so I'd watch yourself, Adam.
And he couches it in all, in courage and willing to put his career on the line and so on and so forth. Continuing to term this, and we said this from the beginning, Jonathan Turley from George Washington Law had it exactly right. It wasn't so much an insurrection as it was a desecration. Yes, there apparently was some planning for violence ahead of time. But I mean, you'll pardon me, even as noxious as putting pipe bombs out in the offices of the RNC and DNC and some of the other violence that was committed on that day or planned for that day, even as reprehensible as that is, the idea that this was an organized insurrection to overthrow the government and presented a real threat to the future of small d democracy in the United States is laughable. But it's not getting laughed away. That storyline is being pushed relentlessly. And now, with the Biden administration, you have law enforcement and intelligence agencies, the Director of National Intelligence, being directed to root out violent extremism in this country, you know, domestic terrorism, people who engage in hate speech, those sorts of generic categories that the left is wont to apply to anybody who doesn't wear a mask. It's serious business. I mean, at least if you don't want what happened in 20, what happened in November of last year, and what's been happening culturally for the last 50 years, to not just increase in pace, which is going to happen, but to be irreversible, because this will be how it is, except, you know, continuing to deteriorate for the next two generations. Listen to what I'm talking about. Adam Kinzinger, okay, on The View, putting his career ahead of his, or putting his country, principles ahead of his career is a small price to pay. Putting his career on the line to support the impeachment of President Trump, to support Liz Cheney, to call for this the committee assignments to be stripped from Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's a small price.
Congressman, you were the first Republican in Congress to come out and call for President Trump to be removed from office after the Capitol attack, either through the 25th Amendment or with a second impeachment, calling him unfit and unwell. What have these past few weeks been like for you in terms of any backlash you faced?
Well, there's been backlash. You know, it's yeah, within the party base, there's some, of course, you know, as we'd expect. There's also been a whole lot of outpouring from people that, you know, just said, thanks for saying it, right? I've heard it even among some of my colleagues, thanks for speaking up. You know, and what it comes down to is maybe there's backlash, maybe there's not. But, you know, putting your career on the line, when we're going out and asking young people to be willing to fight and die to defend this country, you know, being willing to give your career up to defend that same cause, that fidelity to the Constitution is a small price to pay.
Hero.
Right.
Patting himself on the back. Oh, I did such a good job.
Compare that to Jonathan Tobin writing in The Federalist. The only possible response to the Democrats' attack is to refute the charge that what happened on January 6th was anything like an insurrection or sedition. Even if the challenge to the Electoral College result was poorly reasoned and constitutionally impossible, the pro-Trump protest that the president addressed was neither illegal nor a threat to democracy. However misguided or intemperate his remarks might have been, the minority of those who came to support Trump, who violated the law, as opposed to merely exercising their right to protest, like those who took part in the quote-unquote mostly peaceful BLM protests, deserve severe punishment. But their conduct cannot be treated as something that can discredit everyone who applauded Trump that day or wished for a different outcome last November. And Adam Kinzinger is an accessory after the fact to doing exactly what the left is doing, as described by Jonathan Tobin. That's what he's doing, whether he realizes or not. And then he goes on to address Marjorie Taylor Greene, because it's a lot easier to focus on Marjorie Taylor Greene and as the means to sidle up to the D.C. press corps than it and I don't know, raise some cash from Lincoln Project donors. Maybe he can retain John Weaver for his Country First.
That's what he's going to do.
Well, he's not going to
retain John Weaver, but I'm saying the funds that the left donated to the Lincoln Project will now go to his Country First super PAC.
Well, the Lincoln Project didn't go away.
Well, I don't see, after John Weaver being in charge, you think people are still going to donate money to the Lincoln Project?
Of course. John Weaver, they're outraged.
Gross.
They're outraged. He's no longer part of this. I was just as shocked as you are. Now let's continue destroying the Republican Party to some extent from within, or certainly from the establishmentarian angle, and that's what Kinzinger wants to participate in as well. It's a lot easier to do that and gain profile. That's how you gain profile, in point of fact, and the dollars associated with that profile, than it is to articulate anything specific about those convictions and principles he keeps talking about generically.
Why don't they just come out and say, get her off? She's an outrage. And she is, in fact, a cancer on the GOP. And we're better than that. Why don't they just come out and say that?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, because I think that's what they should say. You know, when we're sitting here and debating removing Liz Cheney from her leadership post, whose conservative credentials are unmatched, you know, because she voted her conscience, and then we're debating and kind of hem-hawing over what to do with, you know, Jewish space laser conspiracies and Sandy Hook truthers and 9/11 truthers, you know, that's really what the battle for the heart and soul of the party is.
Is that what it is? By the way, the outrage. She's a cancer. She's an outrage. Just a couple of days ago when he released his Country First video, Adam Kinzinger said this.
Republicans must say enough is enough. It's time to unplug the outrage machine.
I guess he plugged it back in. I guess it's only appropriate to keep it plugged in if it's going in the direction that he so desires, in furtherance of ostensibly the political opponents of the Republican Party. This is exactly how you have a Republican Party that collapses in on itself. I mean, were Kinzinger to be anything more than a backbencher, what Kinzinger is doing is what the leadership of the Illinois Republican Party did for the better part of 30 years, which is why it no longer exists. But that leadership persists because nobody wants to be a part of it who's serious in any in any way. Waste of time. And some serious people get involved. They see it from the inside and then they leave because it's a waste of time, because it's led by people like this. Thankfully, right now, at least, that is not the leadership of the Republican Party in the House and even in the Senate. But it could be. And if it is, then what you will have is exactly what Jonathan Tobin is warning. You will have the left unimpeded in their characterization of everyone who provided any support in any way that is discernible, that is identifiable. They're part of the white GOP Confederacy, white supremacist Confederacy, and that's a party that should never have any power in America again because it has no legitimacy. And I suspect they'll be able to beat that drum successfully, at least electorally, for a couple of generations if you don't attack that false narrative that is being pushed everywhere right now by the Biden administration as well as by Republicans like Adam Kinzinger. John, on the Near West Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, I've been concerned about Kinzinger frantically going around trying to get support for his opposition to this conspiracy. He even went to CNN and MSNBC with hat in hand begging them to support him, and they're the most vicious critics of his party. I told a screener, the people in this woman from Georgia, her name escapes me, know more about the deep state and the international or national sex abuse ring than any constituency in the country. That's the reason I believe this smokescreen about kooking it. They do have kooks attach themselves to all movements, but these people are on target, and that's why this tremendous furor is directed against them. That's my opinion.
All right, John. The Marjorie Taylor Greene stuff, I mean, is like some of the stuff that she posts and says craziness.
It is, but she did it before she was a congresswoman, and she apologized yesterday. I don't like what she did, but are you going to hold her accountable for things she did before she took office? And
yes,
but her constituents knew that, Dan, and they voted for her anyway.
Well, who knows what her constituents knew? It was a crowded primary. She emerged, and it's a very heavily Republican district. Who knows? Constituents don't know a lot of things about people until they get into office, and a lot of things are missed in campaigns.
No, you're right. You're right. That's true.
Should people be held accountable for what they said before they were a member of Congress? Of course they should. She wasn't a child. She just behaved like one. So of course they should. But should she be stripped of committee assignments? I mean, here's what's happening. It happened yesterday. It probably happened today. Is the Republican caucus is taking the Wall Street Journal position. The 61 people voted against Liz Cheney to remain as number three in the House. That's sort of a rebuke. There'll be some sort of rebuke of Marjorie Taylor Greene, and then, you know, she'll be on notice that if there is any more of that, then she will face additional disciplinary action, like being stripped of committee assignments. So she'll have a chance, perhaps, she's only a month in, to prove up what kind of congressperson she's going to be. And you know, we'll see. And Liz Cheney stays in leadership, and then everybody sort of moves beyond this, because that's where Kevin McCarthy needs this to go. Everybody moving beyond this factionalization, litmus testing over Liz Cheney or Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's unhelpful to his mission of taking back the House in 22.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dr. Yerkes is in Oak Lawn. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan, Amy. This is Dr. Yerkes in Oak Lawn. I'm actually battling COVID for the second time. I just wanted to tell you that Kinzinger has already divided us by voting to impeach President Trump. Your thoughts?
Thanks for the call. I think that's a view that's shared by a lot of people, which is probably only why 10 did, among other reasons, because the underlying case doesn't warrant it. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Hi, good morning, you guys. I'm not supposed to say you guys.
Oh, yeah, I'm okay. Very offended.
We'll let it slide.
Yeah,
I love
you
it.
Use
okay.
People.
Quickly, Candace.
Yes, I am ready to spend $1,000 on a billboard in Kinzinger's district. And anybody wants to join me, just call Dan and Amy and get my information. But he is smearing my family, and he is putting danger. I just think what he's saying is very dangerous, and it's dangerous towards people like us. And I've been loyal to the GOP for 15 years, and so I, you know, if he's going to smear me, I'm going to smear him.
okay, Candace. I was talking about essentially conceding the left's point that everybody who supports Trump, even if they had nothing to do with any violence on January 6th or any time else, is some sort of insurrectionist, which is what the left's narrative is. There's no question about that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and I think that the realities are that the Biden administration wants, well, the Biden administration wants a New York Times op-ed trial ballooning the idea of a reality czar to, you know, enter into an era where we can rely on a ministry of truth to tell us what's true and false. Gosh, it's fun to live in a Rand novel. But if we're going to have one, and I'll get to that op-ed in a second, first case that reality czar could take up is AOC. And all of this posting she continues to do about what her experience was on January 6th. She's characterized herself as having a near-death experience in the Capitol building.
Yeah, she said so much as, you know, she thought she was going to die.
She said she was in her office, which is in the Cannon building, where rioters did not breach.
Yeah, they were in the Capitol Rotunda.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, I know what it was.
What?
Everybody's focused on that, the inconsistency of her near-death experience at the Capitol when she wasn't at the Capitol. She was in her office at the Cannon building. I know what it was. She had a near-death experience with a Capitol police officer. And she actually talked about it on Instagram.
There was no partner, was not yelling, you know, Capitol Police, et cetera, et cetera. But then it didn't feel right, because he was looking at me with a tremendous amount of anger and hostility. And things weren't adding up. Like, there was no partner there. And there was, no one was yelling. He wasn't yelling like, this is Capitol Police, this is Capitol Police. And he was looking at me in all of this anger and hostility. And at first, you know, in my brain and in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I just came from this super intense experience just now. Maybe I'm reading into this, right? Like, maybe I'm projecting, like something onto him that like, maybe I'm just seeing anger, but maybe he's not trying to be angry. But I talked to G, my legislative director, after the fact, and he said, no, I didn't know if he was there to help us or hurt us either. And G was actually like, this man came with so much hostility that G was sizing him up and didn't know if he was going to have to fight him. Like, that is how like aggressive the situation was in that moment. And we couldn't even tell, we couldn't read if like this was a good situation or a bad situation. It was so, like, you know, like so many other communities in this country, like, just that presence doesn't necessarily give you a clear signal if you're safe or not. And so the situation did not feel okay. And then he just looks at me and yells at me, and he just goes, go down and then go to this other building. I'm not gonna like name the specific building, but he basically says, go down and go to this building. But he just says the name of the building, doesn't say anything else. But we're so rattled.
Okay. She thought she was hiding from the mob. It turned out it was Capitol Police. Well, because this representative from South Carolina, Nancy Mace, her office was two doors down from AOC's, and she says people, protesters never came down the hallway. They were never in any physical danger from rioters, and it was the Capitol Police who went there to tell them to leave.
You just heard her talking for 2 minutes about her interaction with the Capitol Police officer.
I know, but I mean, she makes it sound like she was hiding from the mob?
That is one of the most important women in the world.
And if she was 300 pounds and had acne, nobody would care what she says. But she's good looking and she's young and people are like, oh, she's a young Democrat. We've got to get behind her. And they don't care about her policies. They just care about her looks. Stupid.
So we've broken this case wide open. Her near-death experience was what she just recounted with that Capitol police officer. Now, again, that Capitol police officer could have been programmed, you know, naked gun style like O.J. Simpson was by Ted Cruz to assassinate her. And that's why her legislative aide, G, was getting ready to throw down with the Capitol police officer because he had a menacing look.
Is G friends with Corn Pop?
It is just stunning. And I could listen to her all day. Actually, I think we should use Instagram posts from AOC where she inveighs on a particular topic like that as a way to make terrorists talk. We will continue to expose you to AOC videos until you tell us what your nefarious plans are, that sort of thing, like, you know, playing annoying music as a means of torturing prisoners and so forth to make them talk.
I mean, she's so out of her mind. She wants Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley to resign because she thinks that they remain a present danger and that they're going to do it again, Dan. Mm-hmm. Do what again? Try and kill her?
Did you catch the kicker at the end? You see, she's just like you. She's had the same experience as you. So she didn't know what to do in that moment because the Capitol police officer basically sounds like doing his job and having to handle a dingbat like AOC and protect her nonetheless. She looked into the face of that police officer and something wasn't right. It didn't feel right. She was afraid. And so this is how minorities feel about the police in urban centers. That's the problem. And she put her finger on it. She's a living example of it. She is in solidarity with you, brother and sister, when it comes to police, because she had this experience in her office building in D.C. with a Capitol police officer getting her to evacuate to some space that I presume they believed was more fortified. And
a building that should remain nameless.
And she was uncomfortable. And so that's why we have the problems we have in urban centers. It's the police not making people who they're protecting feel comfortable, you see. Do you pick that up? You should have. Because, you know, she's too stupid to be any more subtle than she is.
On Twitter yesterday, there was a hashtag, AOC Smollett. That's her new last name.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it was a made-up story, just like Jussie Smollett.
Comparison. This is somebody who is a celebrity, international celebrity, you know, brought to opine on policy, all sorts of policies, go to for so many people who think they're following politics and policy by watching her ignorant videos. It's an important person, right? Well, Denzel Washington is an actual celebrity who's earned his celebrity by being a great actor. And he recently did an interview promoting his new film, The Little Things, which I saw. I watched yesterday. It was pretty good. I mean, all Denzel Washington movies. It wasn't his best. All Denzel Washingtons are good. All Denzel Washington movies are good because he's such a great actor. And there was good at Jared Leto was in it, Rami Malek. It's a good cast. It wasn't great, but it was pretty good. It's definitely worth seeing.
Okay. What's your favorite Denzel Washington movie? What's the one when he was a pilot and he flew the plane upside down?
Flight.
That was a good one.
Good.
He's good. He really doesn't make a bad movie.
I liked him in the Equalizer. The two Equalizer movies. He's great. I will say, gosh, I'm just trying to do it in my head. I'm going to say He Got Game.
Okay.
I'm going to say he got. We'll also take calls on your favorite Denzel Washington movie since that's been brought up.
Yes,
I'm going to say he got game, or, you know, right with Ray Allen, right? The former Celtic standout. I'm going to say he got game. Okay. Denzel Washington, though, talking, because he plays a law enforcement officer in this film, promoting a film, Yahoo Entertainment. I have the utmost respect for what they do, talking about police, for what our soldiers do, people that sacrifice their lives. I just don't care for people who put those kind of people down. Good. If it weren't for them, we would not have the freedom to complain about what they do. He had talked about doing a ride-along with a police sergeant while preparing for his film 30 years ago, Ricochet, which is also good. I went on a call with a sergeant. We got a call of a man outside his house with a rifle that was distraught. We pulled up and did a U-turn past the house and came up short of the house. He told me to sit in the car, which I was going to do. I wasn't getting out. He got out, the officer did. As he got out, another car came screaming up. Two young people jumped out screaming. As it turned out, it was their grandfather. This policeman defused the entire situation by just remaining calm. It showed me in an instant how they can lose their life. He didn't overreact. He could have pulled his gun out. He could pull his gun out and shot the people that came up driving real fast. He could have shot that old man that was distraught and a bit confused. I think he was suffering a little bit from dementia. But in an instant, it taught me, and I never forgot it, that what our law enforcement people have to deal with moment to moment, second to second. Interesting. Well, that doesn't sound like that's Black Lives Matter friendly. Best Denzel Washington movie, tweet from Danny C, Training Day.
Oh, yeah. Training Day was good. That was really good.
Not much of an Ethan Hawke fan, so maybe I didn't enjoy Training Day as much as I could have. Vic in Tinley Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, how you doing? I'd just like to tell you that from someone that suffered trauma twice in my life, big time, she's just telling a story. She's an actress. I can't believe anything, and I would like to see this policeman come forward with the real story. I mean, anonymously, with the real story of what actually, if anything even happened.
Well, he
thanks
did.
A lot.
Thanks,
yeah.
Vic. I would like to as well, and I would like him not to be anonymous because this is a person whose character was just attacked by AOC, suggesting he was being unprofessional in the way that he was interacting with her or her staff. You know, she didn't feel right. Something wasn't right. He was looking menacing, so on and so forth. He just yelled at me. Oh, golly.
Oh, my gosh. Maybe he's trying to save you, idiot.
And using that as the basis to take a cheap shot at law enforcement generally, I would like them. This is somebody who's
a minority
millions of followers on social media. Again, a completely media manufactured celebrity, and she doesn't have 2 cents to knock around between her ears. That doesn't matter. So I would like some people to stand up against this. I would like to hear from that Capitol police officer. Vic, you're right. Can't just be pundits and radio talk shows. Like people who are being targeted, people who are being used as fodder for heroic tales that politicians spin, they should come forward. They need to come forward. Knock some of these people off their pedestals they don't belong upon. Philip in Blue Island.
She doesn't belong on a pedestal. Maybe she doesn't belong on a pedestal, but she does belong in Congress, and the people voted her in. There were a lot of police.
Stop. I'm not going to let you make arguments against something that nobody said. Yeah, I know she was elected. I know she was elected to Congress. I'm not. Did I call for her to be? Did I call for her to be removed from Congress? No.
No, you just said a pedestal, and I said that she belongs on a pedestal to the people that voted her in the Congress.
Yeah.
What is wrong with you? And I know y'all are mad. Trump lost. He lost. And y'all still supporting a woman who supported a lot of this crazy QAnon stuff. She's running around saying that a lot of these school shootings were unreal, and y'all supporting that. But y'all, look at this woman.
Really?
She tells her story.
Really? Hold on, Philip. You don't get to just talk over me. I don't know if you understand how conversations work. You've called into this show enough, you should. I just put you on hold. So I'll let you talk. You're not going to come on this show and say that we're promoting Sandy Hook conspiracies or we're promoting those who promote Sandy Hook conspiracies, because that is a lie. You're not going to get away with it. You can try to lie about us. At least you're doing it to our faces. So I give you that much credit. But you're not going to get away with it. and you're not going to just be able to talk over us as the means to get away with it. So if you want to respond to something that was actually said on this program, you can do that. If you want to manufacture things you wish were said so you can respond to those, then you're going to be interrupted. Try again. Go ahead, Philip.
Again, a lot of what y'all calling her silly, y'all calling her stupid childish names, y'all assassinating her character. If she had a traumatic
experience.
She thinks
Ted Cruz is trying to kill her. That's wacky. She's nuts. I'm sorry.
Ted Cruz was a vital part of why this insurrection happened.
Right.
Okay,
were they trying to kill? Did they say, let's hang Mike Pence? Did they say, where is Nancy Pelosi?
Who's they?
Who's they?
The people, the insurrectionists. What are y'all asking? Why? Who is they?
Yeah, who's
they? They were saying, hang Mike Pence. Mm-hmm. The Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, the Proud Boys are now part of this terrorist whatever. They're being in Canada, being labeled as a terrorist group.
Yeah,
I don't see y'all denouncing Proud Boys. I don't see y'all denouncing, but y'all denouncing ALC.
Well, that's because you only listen to the things that you want to hear. Thanks for the call, Philip. Because from day one and always, and for day one of my life when I could articulate a position, I've opposed violence as the means to political ends. I don't care who does it. We talked about this straight away after January 6th and what happened. Couldn't have been more clear. But you don't want to hear that, Philip, because you're in the business of demagoguing. You're in the business of the gaslighting project. Your desire is to characterize anybody who voted for Trump, even offered so much as a vote for Trump because they didn't like Hillary Clinton or they didn't like Joe Biden or they liked some of the things that Trump did in his first term, even if they didn't like his personality or so on and so forth. You're in the business of characterizing those people as Proud Boys and violent insurrectionists. And that's a lie, too. So you took up about 2 minutes of our time as a perfect example of what we've been talking about in this show. People on the left being gaslighted by ignoramuses like AOC to come on talk shows and repeat the lines that they've heard on Instagram posts from AOC, which are lies. And rank conspiracy theories and character attempts at character assassination that you project onto us. That's what's actually happening. Couldn't be clearer. So I appreciate the call. You're a great example of the bad example. James in Westmont.
Bad examples, good man. Anyway, I forgot my train of thought. Man on Fire, my favorite Denzel Washington movie. And the Equalizer movies were great as well. So that's great movies. And Philip, yes, AOC did lie about it, especially when she said she had a brain. So we all know that ain't true.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, this is somebody who's mystified by a garbage disposal, but we're not allowed to make fun of her. Right. We make fun of politicians as a matter of course. Nobody's off limits, particularly somebody as ignorant. Ignorant as AOC. Man on Fire, I think I'm going to have to rescind what? He Got Game and put that as my second favorite Denzel Washington, because Man on Fire was awesome. That was a remake.
Sounds like you like it better than your original suggestion.
Well, yeah. Man on Fire is my favorite Denzel Washington movie. I forgot about it. I don't know how I forgot about it. It's a remake. Scott Glenn played the Denzel Washington role in the first iteration of Man on Fire. Denzel Washington.
Remember that.
Denzel Washington's was much better. That was fantastic movie. Oh, you know what the other one? Now I'm going to have to. He Got Game.
Here he goes. Here, all right.
Has to drop to three.
Because
you know the other one.
What?
Book of Eli.
Oh, yes.
Denzel and Gary Oldham.
That was really good.
Yeah. Man on Fire, Book of Eli. Maybe Book of Eli, Man on Fire, He Got Game. I'm going to have to work this out on the break. Tim in Mundelein.
Hey, how are you guys doing this morning?
Go ahead.
How you guys doing this morning?
We're good, great, Tim.
Good.
What's
Go
up?
Ahead, Tim.
I'm great. First of all, I just want to say, hi to you guys. Hi to my mom, because I know she's listening this morning. We always listen. And I just want to say, this is just another example of how us soldiers, us police officers, I was a soldier in particular, we're only used when it's convenient. And that's really all I wanted to say is we're just used when it's convenient. And you guys have a fantastic day.
Thanks for the call, Tim.
And thanks for your service.
You too. That's a good point. Dawn in Plainfield.
I'm sorry he feels that way. Remember The Titans?
That was
a fantastic movie.
That's good.
That's a good one.
And I wasn't going to comment on Philip's comment, but I would just like to tell him that for people like me, I really don't care what letter comes after your name, whether you're Republican or Democrat. My issue is the stance that she speaks. You know, how are things going on locally for her? How are things going in her state? Are they flourishing in California? Not really. As a matter of fact, there were 800 families who sued the state to continue to do in-person learning. These are kids with special needs. And they had to sue the state to get them to do that. 800 families. And they won.
Yeah.
It was just settled.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I mentioned it. I want to prove up just so you don't think I've lost my grasp on reality. The prospect of a reality czar. This from technology reporter Kevin Roos in the New York Times. Several experts I spoke with recommended that the Biden administration put together a cross-agency task force to tackle disinformation and domestic extremism, which would be led by something like a quote-unquote reality czar. Oh. Yeah. As I said, Ministry of Truth, anybody? That should work out well.
Who should get that job, too?
This is the way to deal with QAnon social media posts and the OAN newscasts and anything else that they can tag under the headers of disinformation and domestic extremism. This will really be a wondrous development in the rule of law for a free society, won't it? For more on this and a couple other topics, pleased to be rejoined again by Adam Mill, an attorney specializing in labor and employment, public administration law, I should say, contributor to The Federalist, amgreatness.com, and The Daily Caller. Adam, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Dan and Amy. It's a great morning.
What about that? Somebody to make sure everybody knows what the truth is and get those domestic terrorists who are trafficking in untruths under heel.
Yeah, I mean, this is really chilling. We have a number of investigations that have been opened up from the Capitol Hill protests and the Capitol Hill riots. And the FBI is fanning out across the country. And I believe the first arrest has already been made of somebody who did not enter the Capitol building, did not destroy any property, but while spending time in front of the microphone, apparently said something that upset people. And now if you upset people and they take action as a result of you upsetting them, then you're responsible for their actions if you're conservative. If you're not conservative, then it's a completely different rule. You can stand there in front of a microphone, you can call to burn things down, and you won't be arrested, and you're everything will be just fine. But yeah, I think that the Ministry of Truth absolutely comes to mind. It's amazing how people can say something like a czar, a reality czar, and not understand the historic implications, and that's the kind of thing that's the kind of position that exists in North Korea or China. And it's I don't know if it's ignorance of history or if they're enjoying getting our hackles up for the people who do know history.
Well, history, what history? We're starting fresh. All that's wiped away, including any foundations of a free society. This is why if you raise the Supreme Court standard in Brandenburg with respect to hate speech, well, that's just quickly dismissed. If you raise the specter of the rule of law. You don't understand, Adam. What we have here is a problem. We have people who don't understand what the truth is, and this is a way to solve that problem. We are completely unconstrained by things like the Constitution or federal statutory law or Supreme Court jurisprudence.
Yeah, and Dan, I think the latest article I wrote on was about basically this break that our executive branch is making from the Constitution. You know, when you start with the idea that all federal employees are required to make one oath of loyalty, and that oath of loyalty is to the Constitution itself. It's not to Joe Biden, it's not to James Comey, it's not to get Trump. It's to the Constitution. And this kind of erosion of what does the Constitution mean, well, it means whatever leftists say it means, has really kind of made it so that that oath doesn't mean anything either. And what I wrote about recently was this this Kevin Kleinsmith plea deal, which, not under the First Amendment, but under the Fourth Amendment and also the separation of powers. We had a huge problem with the Crossfire Hurricane investigation. What happened was in August of 2016, as they were pivoting away from trying to not investigate Hillary Clinton and turn up this or gin up this investigation of Donald Trump, they were casting about for somebody to do one of these intrusive FISA warrants against. It's a wraparound warrant that basically allows them to tap everything. And, you think about your cell phone has a camera and has a microphone in it. So does your computer, your mail. I mean, just everything that the government could possibly surveil, plus two hops. So if you're talking to your best friend and your best friend is talking to somebody, these FISA warrants allow the government to look into those relationships too. So it's two concentric circles away. So it's a huge, it's incredibly powerful. Well, they looked at George Papadopoulos. They looked at Michael Flynn. They looked at a bunch of these Trump associates, but they settled on Carter Page because Carter Page was going back and forth to Russia. He was styled himself as an expert on Russia, and he was associated with the Trump campaign, which had named him as like an advisor or something like that. So in August, what they need to get a warrant is probable cause that Carter Page is a spy for Russia, and it needs to be reasonable. The warrant needs to be a reasonable way of gaining the information. They just had two problems. First, Carter Page got wind of the fact that the FBI was coming after him. So he wrote an open letter published in the Washington Post to James Comey saying, "Hey, I hear you have questions about my Russia connections. Send an FBI agent over and I will talk to anyone at any time about what I know." And so that makes the search unreasonable when the target is willing to provide the information without a search. And there's reason to believe that he's being truthful. That you can't go through his underwear drawer. You have to at least give that a chance before you go forward. And then the other problem was they didn't have probable cause that he was a Russian spy, because that same month in August, the CIA wrote the FBI a memo saying, "Oh yeah, Carter Page has been working for us from like 2007 to 2013, so only about 3 years before they're planning on doing this. He's been approved for operational information. Like we've been using him as a spy against Russia."
Right. We've talked about that this at some length over the years that it's been. And so the Kleinsmith plea deal for purposely doctoring an email to make it read the opposite of what it legitimately read. And he gets probation, and then we still have the Durham investigation that's an open question, but obviously there is very little hope and a great deal of cynicism about the prospect of that producing anything now. And so where are we left when it comes to law enforcement under our top law enforcement and intelligence agencies?
Right, and I wrote an article a while back about the fact that I didn't expect Kleinsmith to get anything, because Kleinsmith was not in on that conversation in August of 2016 when it turned out that the CIA said Page was a source. He came into the picture in June of 2017 when Carter Page gave an interview and said, I don't know why they're accusing me of being a Russian spy. I've been helping in the intelligence community against Russia for years." And so this set off alarm bells in the Crossfire Hurricane team, and this is all profiled in the Inspector General's report. This isn't me making things up. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's documented. And so they went to Kleinsmith and said, go check with the CIA to see if this is true. Has Carter Page been a source? Now, by now, they've issued the original warrant, a renewal, a second renewal, and now they're working on the third renewal of the warrant. It's been going on for 9 months. So he does, and he finds out exactly what the CIA told the FBI 10 months earlier, which is, oh, yeah, Carter Page has been our source. So he sends two copies of an email that he received from the CIA, the true one and then the doctored one. And he sends that to, he says, the agent that actually swore the affidavit to the FISA court, plus his superiors, plus, you know, anyone who would be in a position of authority in the FBI. Only Kleinsmith has been charged with a crime. But he's not the one who made the decision. Right. He's not the one who pulled the trigger on the affidavit and filed it in front of the FISA court. He doctored the document. But
right, but who pressured him to do it? Right, who pressured him to doctor, you know, or fabricate that email?
Amy, that's the million-dollar question. And it's an easily knowable thing because Kleinsmith has been in the clutches of Durham for, you know, close to a year now. And this has all been, you know, this is all documented by email. They all know who it is, but we don't know who it is.
So the point is, you know, much like they needed some thinly veiled predicate to do what they were intent to do, and so Carter Page provided that, at least so they thought. They have this is, you know, just sort of textbook Fall Guy stuff here. And now with the new administration, you know, play the waiting game, wait out the previous administration, have all your institutional allies go out and slow things down and muddy the waters, which they did. You got your Fall Guy. He gets a slap on the wrist. He can have a soft landing somewhere someday, which I'm sure he will in the not too distant future. And everything moves on like it was before this unfortunate Trump interregnum. Isn't that what's happening?
It's worse than that, because you can look at the people who probably were involved in making this decision, people like Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, James Comey. They're all rich men now. Rod Rosenstein personally signed that last FISA renewal. They're all rich men. They've all, except for Rosenstein, they've all signed book deals. Rosenstein is a partner at a mega law firm right now. So it's like they robbed the bank, and then they wrote a book about it, and then they got rich, and nothing will happen. So, yeah, I mean, Kleinsmith's position is, I never lied to anybody. I told my people the truth, which, you know, I gave them the two versions of the email, and then what they decided to do with the fabricated email, they knowingly did, and you know, that's on them.
Well, Kleinsmith, he's not with the Department of Justice anymore, is he?
He was allowed to continue working for the Department of Justice for a long time.
But he's gone.
And it wasn't until like a month before the Inspector General's report came out, I believe he was allowed to quietly resign. I don't think he was fired.
Go figure.
Adam Mill, attorney specializing in labor and employment and public administration law, contributor to the Federalist, Damn Greatness, and the Daily Caller. Thanks for joining us, Adam. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Hypocrisy is attendant to their status. They're not, that's the way, one of the ways in which they separate themselves from the hoi polloi. Talking about the champagne socialists, the leftist elites. I'm talking about Biden climate czar John Kerry, who was queried about taking a private jet over to Iceland to receive an award from some environmental outfit.
On that issue, pollution, I understand that you came here with a private jet. Is that an environmental way to travel?
If you offset your carbon, it's the only choice for somebody like me who is traveling the world to win this battle. I negotiated the Paris Accords for the United States. I've been involved in this fight for years. I negotiated with President Xi to bring President Xi to the table so we could get Paris. And I believe the time it takes me to get somewhere. I can't sail across the ocean. I have to fly to meet with people and get things done. But what I'm doing almost full time is working to win the battle of climate change. And in the end, if I offset and contribute my life to do this, I'm not going to be put on the defensive.
No, of course
not.
No,
I'm not. Why did his voice get two octaves deeper, too?
I remember sail. John Kerry, when he was running for president, windsurfing off the coast of Boston, if I recall correctly. So maybe you could windsurf over there. No, of course not. Somebody like you, as he described himself, somebody like me can't, you know, be bothered by these things as long as I offset. What does that offsetting look like, by the way? So give me the carbon footprint for the private jet ride over to Iceland, and then how specifically you're offsetting it. I love, like, follow-up. And give me the details, the follow-up on the details. That's what reporters always miss, because then it could have really been more entertaining. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Mark Mills, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, author of several reports, including Mines, Minerals, and Green Energy, A Reality Check, and The New Energy Economy, An Exercise in Magical Thinking. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. That's a heck of an intro with our climate talk.
Yeah, well, so, someone like John Kerry, obviously, the need to monitor their footprint with great detail is beside the point. He's devoted his life to this war against the climate, Mark.
Yeah. Well, I'll just stipulate that politicians of both stripes, but right now in particular of the blue stripe, can do a lot to help us all understand there's a certain amount of arrogance and hypocrisy in the political world. I'm trying hard in my public life to avoid those issues and point to the reality. That's why I call the paper A Reality Check, of what it is that will actually happen for most of us in the real world, no matter what the politicians say, no matter what executive orders get signed. So the virtue signaling of the Paris Accord, we know is, in fact, and it's not an insult, it's a truth, that the nations that signed it, and now we've rejoined it, but set aside that, are virtue signaling, because the pledge that they all made, which is almost 10 years old now, we know for a fact that the pledge is, quote, not enough, right? This is what we're being told to make this energy transition. But even then, none of the nations are meeting their pledges in terms of their energy changes or their carbon dioxide emissions. Oh, I should amend that. Two nations of the sort of 100-plus that signed the accord have met their pledges to shift their behavior. It's Gambia and Morocco.
Well, why can't the United States be more like Gambia and Morocco, Mark?
Well, actually, here's the irony. If what you care about the most is carbon dioxide emissions, the United States is, in fact, the only nation that's reduced its carbon dioxide emissions over the last decade or two. And that's because fracking has made natural gas so cheap, it got cheaper than the cheapest fuel in the world, which is coal. And so the United States has been shifting from coal-fired power plants to natural gas-fired power plants. And this has had a carbon dioxide emissions reduction that's been epic in the United States. But what's been far more important, because that's not why the shift happened, it happened because of economics, it's that the United States' astonishing production of natural gas directly caused the world price for natural gas to decline by something like 2.5-fold, 250%. Which has benefited consumers of everybody's gas over the entire planet. I mean, it's been an astonishing gift to the world. Same is true for oil, by the way. U.S. increasing its oil production has caused the world's oil prices to moderate and even collapse. You know, oil prices, as you probably know, last year briefly went negative on paper because of the demand destruction. It's also because of supply overhang from the United States. That kind of reality has to be, you know, just calibrated in how the world really operates. And then add to that, which was sort of the subject of the sort of focal point of my paper, is if you look at, we'll use the iconic green vehicle, you know, electric car, a Tesla, there's going to be more electric cars in the future. But there's two facts that we should keep in mind. Even if we get a massive increase in the number of electric cars on the road, with or without subsidies, say 100-fold more than we have today, 500 million electric cars in the future in a decade or two, that will only replace 10% of the world's oil. That's it, 10%. And it will have a unintended consequence of stimulating the biggest increase in mining that the world has ever seen to make all the batteries for those cars, because a single battery in an electric car, which weighs 1,000 pounds, it's a pretty big battery, requires mining and processing somewhere 500,000 pounds of materials per car.
What about alternate energy sources such as wind and solar panels?
Well, you know, they let me tell you what I said in the testimony yesterday at the Senate was there are more wind and solar panels in the solar farms and wind farms in the world now than there used to be because set-aside subsidies, they're far better than they ever used to be. But using more of them also increases mining. About 10 times more materials are needed per unit of energy to deliver energy with wind farms and solar farms than with a natural gas fuel cycle, natural gas turbines. 10 times more materials have to be extracted from the earth, processed, energy used to process and move those materials. That has consequences. It has environmental consequences. It has emissions consequences. This has nothing to do with whether it's cheaper or not cheaper. It's not cheaper, despite claims. It's more expensive. But I'm addressing purely the physical reality. In fact, we import 90% of the solar panels that we install in America, 90%. Meanwhile, we are an exporter of natural gas. So replacing natural gas power plants with solar power plants is directly replacing exports and domestic production with imports. Well, creating jobs elsewhere,
yeah,
and chasing the balance of trade.
Well, our friends in Beijing will be ecstatic.
They are, because the largest single producer of solar panels and the materials needed to build them is China.
Oh, there you go.
Perfect. Yeah. Anthony Blinken, I think, just reiterated the position of the Trump-Pompeo administration, which was greatest threat to the United States and to freedom around the world, China. So now we're going to make China instrumental in terms of delivery of our energy capacity. Wonderful. Somebody else who has resurfaced, and I'm real excited about it, is Michael Mann. Michael Mann, not Miami Vice Michael Mann. Michael Mann, the climate scientist who came up with the infamous hockey stick graph of charting temperatures on the Earth over several hundred years. That was proven to be a fraud. If you remember, I'm sure you do, Mark, a great interview that Tim Ball, who's a climate scientist in Canada, gave about 10 years ago, where he said Michael Mann, who is a professor at Penn State, Michael Mann deserves to be in the state pen, not Penn State, for the fraud that he committed with respect to his science, the underlying basis for which he would never disclose, which, of course, runs a bit afoul of academic standards, peer review, and so forth. Anyway, he's back with an op-ed about how wonderful this labeling of climate change a maximum threat by the Biden administration is. He writes, while no war analogy is ever perfect, the Marshall Plan isn't a bad one for characterizing what a post-war battlefield may look like, also known as the European Recovery Program. So that was $15 billion in assistance to finance recovery after World War II. Just as the United States provided economic assistance to help Western European countries heal, Mann writes, we must help individuals, companies, and industries transition off fossil fuels towards a clean energy future. So we need a Marshall Plan for old energy industries to transition to new energy industries. What do you think?
Well, you start out pointing out that I'm illustrating, quote, inconvenient facts. So here's the inconvenient fact, and let's stick with electric cars and Teslas. If we replace an internal combustion engine in America or in Europe with electric vehicle, what we've done, as I pointed out, is de facto exported carbon dioxide emissions, because the materials that are used to make that battery or make its components are fabricated elsewhere, which involves using energy elsewhere. If the materials are made in China, and most of them are, it involves a grid that's two-thirds coal-fired. and the combustion of natural gas and oil as well in that country. If you do the accounting, which is counting the emissions that you create to make the battery, let's say in China, against the emissions you eliminate by not burning oil in America somewhere, you have to balance it out. I mean, it's sort of obvious once you state it. The question you have to ask is, what does the balance look like? And there have been serious studies on this. Europeans have looked at it because they've figured this out. And bottom line is this, that you can not only wipe out, say, a third to half of all the emissions you think you're saving, but depending on where you drive the car and where the batteries, in fact, are made overseas, you can wipe out all the emissions savings that you thought you were creating by driving the electric car. So this kind of battlefield analogy requires understanding what the entire field looks like, and that's not what's going on.
And so what, in your assessment, is the extent of the threat of climate change? You know, because anybody who makes some of the points that you're making, even if you're just drilling down the numbers and you're referencing studies and you're talking about cost benefit and you're detailing the real world choices in a world of scarcity with respect to energy sources, you know, you get tagged as some sort of climate denier. So what's your view on the threat that climate change poses to Western civilization?
Well, you know, Senator Manchin answered that question in the hearings that they did as a baseline, right? He said that the people are talking about getting to what's called net zero by 2050. Right? The world should have a net zero emissions of carbon dioxide by 2050. And he asked the various witnesses, myself included, what we thought the chance of that was. And this is not a question about whether it's good or bad that it should happen. Do you think it can happen? And I reiterated, and I'll say this again now, that it doesn't matter what you think about how the climate's changing. I mean, it just doesn't matter, because it is actually impossible to do what people are claiming. We're not going to get to net zero. It's not going to happen. Nothing that we're talking about results in that outcome in any time frames that have any meaning, not even by 2050. That's only 30 years from now. It's less than 30 years from now, of course. The quantity of materials that have to be produced, the quantity of batteries, the quantity of processing, the quantity of mining, is simply inconceivable that the world is going to do that. We're talking about increasing the mining of copper, nickel, manganese, lithium, all things you need to make all these machines, neodymium, weird elements like dysprosium, and praseodymium, all these things we have to see the world increase its mining and processing of those minerals by somewhere between 200% for some of them to 8,000% increase for many of them. So it's these kinds of growth rates for commodities that are already mined by the millions of tons is not going to happen. It just isn't. I mean, I'm happy.
Where there's an AOC, there's a way, is what I always say, Mark. Senior fellow at the Manhattan.
But you have to adapt, live with, or get resilient. That's the truth of it.
Mark Mill, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, author of several reports, including Mine, Minerals, and Green Energy, A Reality Check, and The New Energy Economy, An Exercise in Magical Thinking. Also check out his recent piece, Ideas for the New Administration on Energy, again over at the Manhattan Institute. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So when the proverbial water recedes and the weather breaks, what will be left of cities like Chicago and New York and so many other big cities around the country as well that don't have the inclement weather during the winter to deal with, but have the same destruction wrought by, I would argue, almost exclusively the policy choices that were made in response to the pandemic? Thinking about big systems that very few people are using at present, as we've discussed. In Chicago, it's Metra and the L, but it's public transportation in big cities around the country. The expense, the number of people employed by those big systems? How do big cities recover, right-size, reimagine themselves after all that has been wrought and will have been wrought by the other side of the pandemic when herd immunity is achieved, perhaps this summer? For some help in thinking about that, pleased to be joined again by Chuck Marone. He's the founder and president of strongtowns.org and the author of Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. Chuck, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, I mean, you've done such, and your organization has done such interesting work over many years thinking about how cities and towns operate at the local level, the way they use scarce resources, the investments they make, the gambits they take. I mean, this is really a watershed moment, perhaps, in American history for big city America. And so I assume you've been doing a lot of thinking about things like mass transit in places like Chicago and New York and L.A. and what that looks like coming out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, going into this pandemic, our cities were very fragile financially. There's a lot of dynamism in our cities. There's a lot going on. And I think when we look at, you know, people and entrepreneurship and, you know, business creation and everything that we value about cities, a lot of that was very active, but it was active on this chassis of insolvency. You know, we were having difficulty running our transit systems prior to the pandemic. We were having difficulty maintaining our streets prior to the pandemic. You know, in Illinois, your financial state, not only of the city, but of the state itself, is a complete basket case. You know, this is giving you no fallback position, you know. You, in a sense, are wholly dependent now on kind of the whims of the bond market and the good graces of whatever federal bailout may come your way. That's a pretty tenuous way to live. And so, yeah, the pandemic and its impacts financially on cities has been huge. And I think the long-term consequences of shifts in living patterns, shifts in preferability, these are unknowns, but they're unknowns that I think pose huge challenges to cities that don't have a lot of capacity to adapt right now.
So if you're a city planner or you're advising a big city mayor and you're saying you see, for example, 20% of Manhattan disappear over the last 6 months, and perhaps no indication that many of those people will be coming back. And obviously the same flight has been happening places like Chicago and L.A. too, which is why all three of those states are going to lose members of Congress after this census. What are you advising them? What are you saying? Here's at least what we need to think about. What are we going to do about big transit systems? What are we going to do about maintenance of infrastructure? What are we going to do about the level of property taxation and, by contrast, the spending on schools, regardless of how they're sort of differently organized in some of the big cities? You know, what are we going to do about unfunded pension liabilities, which is a problem throughout big city America and, frankly, a lot of small town America, too? How do you start getting people to confront this sort of new fiscal reality that they had put off this long? And maybe they'll be able to put off a little bit longer with sort of funny money from the feds, but not much beyond that.
Right. I think this is, you know, there's really, in terms of advice, maybe advice should have, you know, the advice was decades ago. Now it's just dealing with the consequences, right? There's a sense of, you know, austerity is always talked about as, well, we shouldn't do austerity because, you know, it's bad for growth or it's bad for the economy. Austerity is generally not a choice. You know, austerity is a consequence of past actions. And in a lot of ways, yes, we have some places we can invest and some places that we should be, you know, disinvesting from. And we have some policies that we should change and things we should do differently. But the reality is that a lot of this is going to be forced on us. You know, the resolving the pension crisis is going to be forced upon us. There's not a, you know, it's not like we have an option to deal with this or not. We're going to have to. You know, cities, I'm not worried about Chicago and, you know, Manhattan losing population. There's enough people that want to live in these places. But I think the change will be that the kind of population, right? Both of these cities, I mean, Chicago has floated on, you know, kind of this froth of financialization and affluence. And a lot of those people have decamped, you know, for tax reasons, for quality of life reasons, for you know, their, what they perceive as their health or safety reasons. There's a lot of people who will backfill those, but they will be people who are poorer. There'll be people who, you know, are less part of that transaction economy.
Right.
And in some ways, that might be good. I mean, I feel like, you know, the big problem our cities have is not a lack of access to capital, but sometimes like crazy capital in ways. But it's also going to be tough because it's going to force us to confront a lot of these insolvencies that we've just been able to paper over.
And don't you think a lot of families are going to be moving out? I mean, I know five families on our street that moved already because strictly because of CPS. And they're sick of these strikes and sick of all, you know, these e-learning forever experiences that we're having.
Yeah, I feel like for you all in particular, there's a public school situation that needs to be figured out. You know, here in Minnesota, where I'm from, you know, we have a long history of great public education and really valuing it. But we also, I think, culturally have some expectations that, you know, when we prioritize teachers for vaccination, that means we need to get back to work, like we need to get kids back in schools. When we're all sacrificing together, you know, including the people working at the grocery stores that we've called essential workers and the people working in the gas stations that we've called essential workers, you know, getting these kids back in school where they can start learning again, those are essential services. That's an essential worker. You know, let's do that. The dysfunction you have there is a little bit beyond my capacity to understand, but certainly it's something that needs to be resolved and be resolved urgently.
It is beyond most rational people's capacity to understand, so don't feel like you're alone.
Okay.
With respect to, so the areas that, you know, as you say, now we're in the period of dealing with the consequences. We're not really in a position of being strategic thinkers other than in dealing with the consequences. So, for example, these big cities, they're going to have to confront the reality that their headcount at the city level, at the school district level, is too high. The personnel costs are too high, and they're going to need to shrink the personnel costs and, frankly, by inference, the number of people who work in city and county and school district government. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think cities in general are going to have to tighten up their shit. And I think we, you know, I hate to use like these buzzwords because, you know, they've been used for decades. But, you know, in sense of reimagining local government as something that is less hierarchical and less, you know, silos and hierarchies and kind of a U.S. military model of operation. We have different departments. I think we're going to have to really start focusing on geographic teams. How do we serve neighborhoods? How do we get down to the block level? And how do we do that with a staff that is quite frankly leaner and more agile?
So just to make that concrete, so you're talking about things like, you know, there's 10 communities that are adjacent to one another in a county. Not all 10 of them need a public library. You can share one or two public libraries. Not all 10 of them need a public swimming pool, things like this. Not all 10 of them need their own fire department and department staff. Is that what you mean when you talk about regional sharing?
In some ways, but let's you know, we can focus on the library thing for a second. You know, I think libraries are really important. And in fact, in my neighborhood, we have like four libraries, but they're the small little, you know, they're small little libraries. They're not the $50 million thing that you build. I think what we're going to need to do is we're going to need to figure out how to provide these services in a lighter way, in a lighter touch. You know, a library is a really important thing because we can get people access to information, access to literature. You know, libraries are ways people grow their way out of poverty and into prosperity. How do we make those things happen on a more distributed, lower cost kind of scale, as opposed to, you know, how does everybody get the $50 million library with the big parking lots and you know, underground parking facilities and and all that, which is how we tend to approach these things.
Well, but the problem is, I mean, it's just sort of like this is like public choice theory 101. The problem is this is how it should happen. But the incentives are to build Taj Mahals.
Yeah, well, and the incentives largely come from this fact that we can access capital. I mean, that when I say frothy, you know, you're really looking at a state in Illinois that is completely insolvent. I mean, your bond rating is horrible. The state pays their debts in IOUs. The idea that the state or the city, which is in a similar position, would be investing in these large, you know, these large kind of build it and they will come transformative projects. I get the theory and I get, you know, what people are hoping to do, but we have a long track record of that not working, not paying off. It's a little bit like, you know, the big company that is insolvent and you go in and you say, well, we're going to launch three new product lines. No, you know what we're going to do? We're going to tighten up the ship. We're going to look at what we do. We're going to figure out how to do it better. And we're going to figure out how to do it with fewer people. And we're going to focus on the core services that we need to provide and do those exceptionally well. That's what cities need to do right now.
And you know, again, cornerstones of strong towns, strong K-12 systems. That's what attracts families, strong healthcare infrastructure, strong infrastructure in terms of transportation, which was always the calling card for example, Chicago, the Midwest, or New York on the Eastern Seaboard, L.A., on the West Coast, and you know how that is perhaps how the grandiose visions of what those systems are were going to look like once upon a time also need to be recast.
There's no doubt, and you know I think right now today there's big talk of places like Austin and Miami as being you know the places now that are on the receiving end of people. You said in that comment, that question, you know, this is how we attract people. I think for Chicago, and I feel like for, you know, Minneapolis, for my hometown here in central Minnesota, the idea needs to be less about what do we do to make ourselves attractive to people who aren't here now, and instead be what do we do to actually serve the people that are here in front of us that are paying the taxes? What do we do to make their lives better and easier and more functional? And I think if we focus more on that, if that was our obsession, we actually find people wanting to move to our place. Like it wouldn't be a problem attracting people. We just, you know, I think get too obsessed with the flow in a sense. Like, oh, these people moving to Miami, how do we get them back? Well, that's the wrong question. How do we take care of what we've got? That's really should be the obsession right now.
Chuck Marone, founder and president of StrongTowns.org, author of Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. Chuck, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Really appreciate it. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Newly minted Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has called for a 60-day stand-down on the issue of extremism in the military prompted by the January 6th rioting and violence at the Capitol. Stand-downs in the military to provide more are used to provide more discussion between the officers and the rank and file on topics recently, for example, sexual assault, suicide. This is further training, time for further training, discussion, where the units have to focus on issues at hand. So now this is an opportunity for the whole of government approach to what we talked about a bit earlier in the program, which is the effort by the left to characterize everyone, including and most particularly the nonviolent, since the violent represents such an infinitesimal fraction of those in attendance on January 6th, much less in support of Donald Trump nationally, to characterize everyone as an extremist, a purveyor of hate speech. And so this will, you know, right after they get done welcoming all the new clingers to the ranks, they can focus on this violent extremism, hate speech, sewing circles in the military. This is going to be a boon for military preparedness, I suspect. Great recruiting tool. For more on this and the underlying point I was making, we're pleased to be rejoined by Chadwick Moore. He's a contributing editor for The Spectator. Chadwick, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning. Great to be back.
Opening the war against Trump supporters on all fronts is the Biden administration.
Yeah, it seems that way. You know, one thing I think a lot of people struggle with is we're just kind of seeing how effective the authoritarian impulse in the Democrat Party is. I mean, are these competent authoritarian dictators, or are they just sort of bumbling, idiotic, nothing will ever get done because, of course, we have a constitution? Now, they've been very effective being totalitarians, of course, lockdowns in Democrat states and imprisoning people in their own homes and cities and states. But when it comes to enacting these sort of inquisitions that they keep talking about and these hate speech laws, and we just saw the New York Times, I believe it was yesterday, run an op-ed calling for a reality czar, because I guess Ministry of Truth was taken.
Right.
I'm still not sure. You know, if you look at someone like Cuomo, they seem really scary. But then whoever's pulling the strings with Biden, you don't really know who's pulling the strings. But I think it's safe to say it's not him doing a lot of this stuff personally. We don't really know, you know, if they're serious or if they're just sort of wannabe authoritarians.
Well, they're not serious. Gosh, with the amount of people being deplatformed and purged, with the boomerang, actually, of, for example, some proposed regulations of big tech at the state level in both Florida and Minnesota, fines and disclosure requirements if big tech wants to get itself involved in putting its finger on the scale for particular candidates, say, for example, in Florida. Ron DeSantis addressed that the other day. Minnesota, sort of the same thing, $50,000 fines for improperly deplatforming people without cause. You know, the implementation of some of those state regulations may be problematic. I'm sure there'll be core challenges, but nonetheless, it's indicative of a seriousness, at least an assessment that the threat is very serious from those that have disproportionate power in society to silence debate and you know, by extension, opposition.
Right, and this is something. It should go to the courts, and that's a good thing, because this is. I wrote about this a couple of years ago, actually, for the Washington Times. That really the best way, I think, to go after big tech censorship is basically taking the gay marriage approach. So you have to create a political moment. There was no political moment for gay marriage. All right, it was activist state legislatures. Nobody really wanted it at the time. It was activist state legislators that went over the voters to start passing gay marriage. And then you started creating a political moment where other blue states began doing it on their own. That's how you get a case to the Supreme Court. Like, none of this was going to go to the Supreme Court without that momentum. So you take that approach with Silicon Valley censorship. And I mean, there's so many things you get Silicon Valley on that are actually illegal, like RICO, like racketeering and corruption, especially how they coordinate cross-platform to ban people. How they tried to destroy market competition. I mean, you can do all that. Of course, Biden's DOJ wouldn't, and it's weird that Trump's DOJ never even tried. But if you want to go with the speech route, this is a really great way for state legislators to say, okay, in our state, if you ban one of our citizens, because we respect the Constitution, your business is speech, and you benefit from our speech laws in this country, of which there aren't any. If you are lying to people, if you're misleading them, you're people who spent countless hours and money building their platforms, and then it's basically their means of earning a living, and they create jobs, right? You snatch it away from them. Well, we're going to start fining you, all right? So once you have one state, red state, do it, other red states begin picking that up. Now you're creating a political moment where it could go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court could say, you know what, these are perfectly legal. If the state wants to do this, it's fine. That's exactly how gay marriage happened, and nobody really wanted it before that. And,
yeah.
The courts weren't going to take it on.
I remember Obama and Clinton, they were like civil union, then they finally agreed on that, and then eventually Obama embraced same-sex marriage. But real quick, when it comes to big tech censorship, do you think President Trump was silenced because they wanted to have a smooth transition for Biden's first 100 days? Because think about it. If Trump had his Twitter account right now or Instagram and he's got an upcoming impeachment trial beginning on Monday, can you even imagine what it would be like?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if he still had a Twitter account, the news cycle would still be revolving around Trump. It would be hilarious. Of course, it'd be a grind Biden wasn't even president. I didn't think that at first, and then it occurred to me recently, like, oh.
Oh, now I know what they're doing.
Yep. Yeah. Well, yeah, the fact he doesn't have a Twitter account may be very helpful in advance of his impeachment trial next week, actually.
Well, that's another way to look at it, too. Yeah,
it can cut both ways. I was tickled by Jeff Bezos's Fare Thee Well letter to employees the other day when he announced he was stepping down as CEO of Amazon after they recorded their first $100 billion quarter in revenue, fourth quarter of last year. He wrote in part, "As Amazon became large, we decided to use our scale and scope to lead on important social issues. Two high-impact examples are $15 minimum wage and the climate pledge. In both cases, we staked out leadership positions and then asked others to come along with us. In both cases, it's working. Other large companies are coming our way. I hope you're proud of that as well." Again, we're talking mainly these days about big corporations, less so even less so than about big government. And it's not just big corporations; it's big corporations that are networked. And Bezos sort of indicates as such when he talks about how, you know, others played follow the leader with Amazon. Of course they did. Those that could. And then that gets imposed by local governments on those that can't. And then you have a Kroger example in Long Beach, California. Oh, you want to mandate $4 extra for a quote-unquote hero pay for our grocery chain workers? Well, those stores are struggling as it is. That wage for hundreds of employees doesn't make economic sense for us. So no problem. We're just shutting down our two stores in Long Beach. And then the grocery store workers are like, what the hell just happened? What did our city council just do to us? But this issue of networked corporations, as we've seen with the elimination of Parler, as we've seen with other social issues, as Bezos terms them, minimum wage, climate pledge, and so forth. This seems to me where the fight really is, more so than on Capitol Hill, even.
Yeah, because these Amazon and Twitter and Facebook and big tech are running more of our lives and having more impact than obviously like squabbling on Capitol Hill and whatever Congress is trying to do or not do. But the minimum wage thing is so hilarious because these lefties are all for it. And okay, you have the world's largest retailer and one of the richest men in the world who's fighting for this. Why would that be? Why does it benefit Amazon to have $15 minimum wage? Well, because obviously the mom and pop store down the street can't afford that. Their prices are going to go up and you're just going to spend even more money at Amazon. Like, people don't even think this far ahead, you know? And you see the crushing of small businesses. You want $15 minimum wage? Well, great. Every time you go to McDonald's, you're going to be ordering from a screen and basically we're going to enter a time where you never have to deal with another human being ever again in a retail setting.
Well, plus, I mean, this is one of the real hallmarks of the modern left, too, which is I'm a fraud politically, and I know I'm a fraud. Here's how I cover my fraudulence. I support things that the Occupy Wall Street ill-informed Jacobin left wants, like $15 minimum wage. I throw a sop to the public sector unions and the rest of the Jacobin left so as to sort of paper over the fact that politically I'm a fraud. I'm really just interested in behaving one way when it comes to my financial interests and then throwing people bones to keep them away from me. So Amazon being the perfect example, right? The story last week about how they didn't want mail-in voting for unionization within Amazon, but of course, strong proponents of mail-in voting for selecting a president. That they know they're frauds, and this is the way they get away with being frauds politically.
Yeah, and they're banking on the sort of far-left base and the left-wing media consumer to having extremely short attention spans and selective processing of information they like and don't like, so that they can't. I mean, you know, it's why every major globalist corporation in the world, you know, changes their logo to a rainbow flag in June. It's why they all came out in support of Black Lives Matter. It's, you know, paying the left wing piper with the understanding that they can basically just do whatever they want. The things that they're really up to are too complicated for the average lefty to process or even to devote enough time learning about or thinking about. So it's quite simple for to keep the media and people off their backs to these very empty voter support and empty bromides behind things that they honestly don't really care about. It's just the PR.
You were talking about potentially a moment, a political moment coming for big tech. Do you think the Biden order on trans individuals and sports at the K through 12 level, for example, it certainly impacts that, is a moment with respect to the larger cultural fight, the fight for chromosomal science to be followed as well as other science that's always advanced, that the idea that men can play women's sports and subsequently dominate them as is happening is okay, and marginalizing girls' opportunities in sports. Is that a moment, or is that a moment that will be fleeting?
Well, I mean, it's setting the stage for that, certainly, because now you're going to have an opportunity for a biological female high school track star or whatever to have a case, and then that case can work its way up the judicial system, obviously. You know, I think it's going to be a couple years because they don't just happen overnight. But it certainly, that executive order, you know, outraged everyone. And, I mean, of course, probably many more people than we know about because everyone's too afraid to speak up against big trans and the woke mob and whatever. But, I mean, I think it'd be pretty rare to find a biological woman who is extremely comfortable with that, especially someone who maybe played sports in high school. But, you know, people are too scared to speak up, or they'll just falsely pretend that they care about it but are actually raising their eyebrows. So it sets the stage for it. But Obama had done something similar, and we didn't really have anything under him. You know, he basically made it – his executive order made it that they could deny federal dollars to any school that didn't let biological men into girls' locker rooms. Like, what?
So this has been – but it started – I mean, we've had men on girls' teams. You know, this started years ago. And now I hope it does not get worse. But, of course, I mean, it's an opportunity – for guys to get girl scholarships, essentially, to take millions away from girls that have worked so hard to have sports, and now this is the beginning of the end. So if you think if parents are going to fight for anything, it would be for this.
Right, exactly. And just and you're right, it has been around for years, and we've been seeing these news stories. And but the fact that now it's an executive order and people are talking about it is probably raising more consciousness for parents to actually do something. So we'll have to just see if anyone steps up.
Chadwick Moore, contributing editor for The Spectator. Chadwick, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, so I had the opportunity to speak with Bob Mazurkowski the other day. It is National Catholic Schools Week, although Chicago Hope Academy, which he founded, is an independent Christian school, but close enough, rounding error.
And that's where Peyton and Eli were supposed to go.
Well, they should have. Here's what Bob Mazurkowski had to say about how CPS should have run the show, what he's done at Chicago Hope and his team, and what CPS could have done.
We're a high school, Chicago Hope Academy, independent, non-denominational Christian high school. We had about 40 kids transfer in from public schools when they found out they weren't going to open. So in that period, we've had 7 students test positive. One was affected, was a night in the hospital. All the others were back as soon as they were allowed to. We've had 9 staff get it. One of them was my daughter. Instead of running 5 miles a day, she ran 7 miles a day. In general, we had one staff member affected, though, where she was out for a couple of weeks and that was really hurting. But that's we're 287. I actually visited Marist High School, which has 1,200 students on the south side, and had dinner with the principal there, reviewed their new signs up, and they've been open the whole time. They do half in the morning, half in the afternoon. So I think my opinion with CPS is you got every principal has at least a master's or a PhD. They should have let every principal run their show. They know their students the best. They know their families the best. Why would you not let your principals run their own show for each school?
Interesting. That's,
yep.
Interesting
have
thought.
Have the LSC as something. Give up the power to the local school counselor and anybody.
And what are the results in Chicago Hope? 90% black, low income?
Our kids are thriving. Last year, we had 2 Yales, Columbia, Brown. We have a kid at Princeton, Notre Dame, University of Chicago, and a bunch of the military, which we're super proud of. But we know where everybody's going when they walk across the stage.
And again, just to repeat, west side of the city, 90% low income, mostly yeah. Minority kids, right?
Yeah, mostly black. My own kids were the first white kids in the school. And one of them's a principal now. He went to Harvard.
And with respect.
I met that kid who's going to Brown, too. A very bright young man.
And what does Mazakowski think that Lightfoot and the teachers' unions have done by keeping the school shuttered?
Do you think the kids on the west side and the south side are really paying attention on Zoom when it's loud in the background and your mom's getting high? I mean, really, it's ridiculous to think that. And to think that all these juniors and seniors and the low-income south side minority kids and west side, do you think they've been told they don't have to go to school? Do you think they're going to come back for their senior year at 19?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.